Oh man, it was hell. Oops, I can't curse. I can't. Sorry.
John Iovine had a stroke. He's very sick. Could an algorithm keep him from returning to the hospital? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
We are, in effect, trying to turn the patient's own tumor into a vaccine.
The real question is, should somebody somewhere on this planet be trying to solve this problem?
Nothing matters as much as where you do your residency.
This is the first generation. They're putting a Model T in my chest.
The only natural disaster that we can actually do something about.
We were dead wrong.
If stress puts
any
you
kind
at risk
of breast
for...
So what this produces is a protein that tells the cells to divide.
Right,
what they'll do is they'll divide,
like
divide, divide, divide.
That's what it leaks out.
Okay, we're all done. You did great.
On today's show, finally, an answer to a question that has vexed mankind. What causes knuckles to crack? Also, the science behind the foods we crave when we're sick. Chicken soup, anyone? But first up, we're kicking off a new series on The Pulse, Bit by Bit, How Data is Shaping Our Health. Our first story in the series is about algorithms, those complicated formulas that dive through huge amounts of data to reveal results or predict outcomes. Think Amazon's system for recommending the next book you should buy, or the NSA combing through your cell phone calls. Insurance companies are getting into the algorithm action as well. Independence Blue Cross is 1 year into a project that uses information on its members to try to predict who is most at risk for ending up in the hospital again and again because of chronic conditions. Todd Bookman reports.
The first thing out of John Iovine's mouth is an apology.
You got to forgive me if I don't remember too much. I had a stroke.
Signs of that stroke are everywhere. His bed is in the dining room. There's a shower installed in the pantry. John's thin, in blue pajama pants, sitting in a blue wheelchair that he uses to get around. But as for the memory issues, I think he's overstating them.
Jeez, what year do we meet? Like 1952 or something 50, like that?
Yeah. 52, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you met her?
We went to Harding, and that's a school right up here. And I seen this girl in this red, long red sweater and her red hair, and I said, "That's a girl for me." I came out on top.
Carol Iovine, redhead and wife, is on a plastic-covered couch next to John. His stroke, she explains, came in the middle of what can only be called a really bad run. First, he developed an ulcer, then he needed a bowel resection, then the stroke.
And he had pneumonia, jaundice, sepsis, clot in the right lung, and all the above between 10/16/13 to January 3rd of 14.
John spent 79 days in the hospital, some of that unconscious, nearly all of it stuck in a bed.
Oh, man, it was hell.
But that wasn't the end of it. He spent 4 more months in rehab, trying to regain control over the right side of his body.
We just kept working at it, and the next thing, we're looking at him, and his finger was doing this, and we said to the nurse, "Oh, his finger's moving." She said, "Ah, that's just spastic." The next thing, he looked like he was playing a piano. All his fingers were going. I said, "That's not spastic. He's moving." And then we started shaking his hand, and then the doctor would come in. We said, "John, go ahead, shake Doc's hand." He shook the guy. He said, "Whoa." It came back.
John was finally sent back home in April of last year, still very much a work in progress. And this moment in a patient's recovery, when they seemingly have to sink or swim on their own, this is the moment that everyone in the health system is paying a lot of attention to right now. For too long, too many Johns sunk, ended up right back in the hospital. The industry calls these preventable readmissions, and they are a huge drain. Medicare spends something like $15 billion on them annually. That's why it launched a program a few years ago that penalizes hospitals that see too many patients come back in the door. And in turn, that spurred lots of hospitals around the country to pay more attention to the issue and try new programs. Now, insurance companies are also taking a stab at the problem.
So we are trying to identify which patients are likely to be hospitalized in the next 3 months. So that's our target.
This is Samesh Nigam, Chief Informatics Officer for Independence Blue Cross. Independence is working to identify customers most at risk, not just of being readmitted, but everyone sick or frail enough to be on the edge of hospitalization. They're running algorithms on the huge amounts of health data at their disposal. Billing claims, lab readings, medications, height, weight, family history. Plus, they throw in information about neighborhoods, like poverty rates. Just a ton of stuff.
The healthcare data that we provided to build these algorithms is equivalent to, I think, 5 Wikipedias.
They take that 5 Wikipedias worth of data, run the computer algorithm, and out pops a score. High scores for people most at risk of hospitalization, low numbers the opposite. It then assigns the high scores a staff member, what they call a health coach, whose job is to see what these people need.
This coordinated effort then works for the patient to try to get them the right level of education, physician appointments, medication issues, perhaps transportation benefits to go to a doctor, even home care nurses who can go and help with the member. And all of that is beginning to show a pretty significant drop in hospitalization rate in our region.
Nigam says of those identified at highest risk, there's been a 40 to 50% reduction in expected hospital admission rates. That statistic includes the Iovines. Picture Carol's situation. All of a sudden, she's managing new medications, helping John shower, get to the toilet. They need to hire a wheelchair van for each appointment and therapy session. She could use some help. And she gets it in the form of a letter from her new health coach.
It's dated May 1st, and it came May the 8th. And I called the number, and it was Donna Crockett. And boy, did we bond right off the bat. I love her. She's our angel, you know.
That's strong praise to lay on an insurance company employee. Here's an example.
Oh, he was supposed to get blood work done.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to take him to the ER to get blood work. I said, no way. Called Donna. What's going on, Donna? They want me to take him there. No. You have to get an ambulance and all that for blood work? No. And the next thing, a nurse was here taking blood.
Big picture, the pennies spent on Donna arranging things like a visiting nurse are nothing compared to the dollars a hospital admission would cost. And that promise of savings has others paying attention to the power and possible drawbacks of these predictive computer formulas.
So I think there's a lot of interest in the area right now, and really it's a great coming together of the healthcare world and the computer science world, as well as the patient experience world.
Glenn Cohen is a professor at Harvard Law School, and he's written about the legal and ethical concerns raised by the collision of healthcare and big data. One big gray area, whose information is it?
And here there are questions about whether individuals whose data is going to be used to build the engine have the right to opt out. Do they have to affirmatively opt in? Do they have to even be notified that they're being it's being used?
Cohen says this whole field is too new for there to be accepted standards yet for how this information should be handled. For its part, Independence Blue Cross says it follows HIPAA guidelines regarding anonymity and is only using the information to better serve its members. But it doesn't ask people to opt in. It just does it. Again, Sumesh Nigam.
The data is only used to improve or coordinate care, right? And that's something that you would agree is our role.
The early work on hospitalization has been so promising that the company is expanding its predictive analytics program. It's partnering with NYU Langone Medical Center on its next target, type 2 diabetes, trying to spot those most at risk before they start showing symptoms, and then trying to do something about it. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
And this disclosure, Independence Blue Cross is an underwriter of The Pulse. And now it's time for a 50th birthday celebration for Moore's Law. Well, geeky is how we roll here on The Pulse. A quick refresher, Moore's Law refers to an observation made in 1965 by Gordon Moore, who later became the co-founder of Intel. He noted that the number of transistors per square inch on integrated circuits had doubled every year, and he predicted that this would continue for the foreseeable future. What does that mean for us? Well, think back to the big Miami Vice car phones and then look at the size of your cell phone now. Joining us to celebrate the anniversary of this observation is Arnold Thackray. He is founder and chancellor of the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and his new book is Moore's Law, The Life of Gordon Moore, Silicon Valley's Quiet Revolutionary. Arnold, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Can you describe the transistors that Moore predicted would double? What is their role, and how do we see them in action in our daily lives?
They are things that regulate electric current like policemen, switching it off, switching it on, sending it one way, sending it another, and they totally have invaded every aspect of your life. The best example I can give you is every person in the world, if we assume they're all equal, last year bought 8 billion transistors. You say, I didn't do that. But think of your cell phone. Think of your television. Think of the machines that examine you when you're ill. Think of the aeroplane. Think of the automobile. All life is pervaded with transistors, and that's why life is different.
And let's use the example of a cell phone. What does the transistor do inside of the cell phone?
Well, the billions inside a cell phone these days do that switching and directing, because the ultimate miracle is that everything in the universe can be described by a series of ones and zeros. Why you say, why zero and one? Well, that's a way of writing down on or off, on or off. All the time, the only question is on or off, left or right. That's all the transistor wants to know.
How did Moore observe this? How did he make his prediction?
Well, he was one of the guys making those first transistors. A young man, they were trying to do something nobody had actually done commercially. And they were only making 100 of them. That's, you know, all that were needed. But then they found other people wanted them. And then, as a chemist, he began to notice there's really no reason we shouldn't make these smaller. Actually, if we make them smaller, we can make them cheaper, and actually they'll work faster. And he had the wit to see that crystal clear, and he devoted his life single-mindedly to making it happen. He started 2 companies. The one you're more familiar with is called Intel, and Intel is the great transistor producer today. Moore, in the fullness of time, became the richest man in California. It wasn't his intent, his aim, but transistors proved so useful, so ubiquitous, and he was so far ahead of the competition in how to make them smaller, faster, better, cheaper, that he, on the side, grew very rich.
Can the law continue to go on, though, or is it pushing up against some limits?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because it is going to hit a limit, and we have lived for 50-plus years with this comfortable background phenomenon that smaller, better, cheaper, faster just happens. But if you keep shrinking size, you eventually get down toward the size of a silicon atom. And when you get down towards close to the size of a silicon atom, that's it, folks. Moore's law is over. It's somewhere within the next decade. It's going to grind to a stop. You'll have to think of something else if you want the world to go on moving ahead in the way it has over the last 50 years.
Arnold Thackeray, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Arnold Thackeray is founder and chancellor of the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and his new book is Moore's Law, The Life of Gordon Moore, Silicon Valley's Quiet Revolutionary. Coming up on The Pulse, working 60-plus hours a week as a physician and sitting down at night in front of a computer to get an MBA? That sounds nuts, right? But more and more doctors want that double degree. Up next on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca invests more than $4 billion each year in the discovery and development of innovative medicines, collaborating with noted scientists and academic institutions. AstraZeneca's combination of capabilities in small molecules, biologics, immunotherapies, and protein engineering is reinforced by a strong focus on translational science and personalized healthcare. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Med students tend to describe getting an MD as a grueling journey with endless studying, tough exams, and many sleepless nights. MBA students in business school say much the same about their degree. Some may add in a super competitive for good measure. What's motivating a new generation of doctors to get both of these degrees? Tanya English takes a look.
At the Rothman Institute, spine surgeon Alexander Vaccaro has patients prepped and waiting for him in four different exam rooms, all before 8 o'clock in the morning.
Guys, I need to see this gentleman's MRI scan. Who saw this gentleman?
Hovering all around like an entourage are medical assistants getting what he needs and younger doctors watching him work.
This is a gentleman who has really bad back pain, so my job is to scare him out of wanting surgery. He's a candidate for surgery, but I don't like to do back pain surgery because it has a high failure rate, so watch closely.
Inside, an aging dad is worried he can't keep up with his six-year-old son. Vaccaro listens.
The issue that's really frustrating me is...
Then explains that surgery is a 50-50 bet. Only marriage has worse odds.
How many marriages have you had?
Two.
Hey, see, there you go.
Man, I'm working on three.
Vaccaro works more than 60 hours each week. He's a sought-after specialist, and at age 53, he has a two-month-old baby at home. So what else could he possibly want? Vaccaro wants an MBA. So he spends an extra 15 to 20 hours each week doing homework.
There's this sort of subtle insecurity most physicians have when we go into practice where we really don't understand basic business models.
Doctors get tired, he says, of going hat in hand to hospital managers and begging them to buy equipment.
Mr. Administrator, can I have an MRI scan? No, you can't because you can't afford it. Okay, but I really want one. No, I'm sorry, you can't afford it, so you can't have it. Okay, thanks. That's how it was 10 years ago.
At mid-career, Vaccaro changed his approach. He started pursuing a business degree, and soon after, Rothman tapped him to be president of the practice.
Now I become creative, and I'm no longer responsible as a child looking to the parent, which is the institution I work at, to look for money. Now I can control the dollar.
Vaccaro is earning his MBA through Temple University's Fox School of Business, and he's doing it online.
Okay, it's 8 o'clock. Welcome, everyone, to session number two.
In this class, there are three physician students. Associate Dean Bill Aronson says busy doctors like having the flexibility to do required meeting on their own time, and then they meet up online.
Every Thursday, 8 to 10 p.m., you know you're going to be in your virtual classroom.
Aronson says weekend programs and online classes work especially well for physicians in their 30s and 40s, when they're just beginning to take on leadership roles at work.
And they get frustrated and they get angry and then all of a sudden, well, what do you mean I can't use that test? I need that test. Then they go into an MBA program.
There's an association of MD-MBA programs, but no information yet on whether doctors with an MBA get promoted faster or end up earning more money. But a master's degree from a top school can cost more than $100,000. So lots of students invest in an MBA with hopes of cashing in later.
Healthcare today is what we affectionately call a hot mess. If you were down south, you'd be hearing that. Anytime you've got all of the different problems and issues, there are also lots of opportunities.
That's Jim Dawkins. He's a healthcare management professor at Rockhurst University in Kansas City. Health spending accounts for nearly a fifth of the U.S. economy. And that, Dawkins says, makes medicine big business. Some of the healthcare sector's toughest problems or opportunities are actually customer service issues. At the Wharton School in Philadelphia, Professor June Kenney says those are problems that business people know how to fix.
And then there's the whole front office aspects of it, you know, where sometimes I think most of people's complaints about their physician office is more about the support staff than it is about the physician. It's about things like wait times or, you know, efficiency of follow-up.
Kenny says companies like Starbucks train workers to give shoppers a customer-friendly experience, but doctors don't often learn those skills in school. Though medical students can get that training in a dual MD-MBA program. In the early 1990s, there were fewer than 10 of those programs. Today, there are more than 65 across the country. And now, about 500 students earn a dual degree each year. Kenny says Wharton's program attracts young, ambitious people who are thinking ahead about their future.
Is medicine, as it's traditionally defined, how I really want to spend my career, or do I want more options?
I'll use the word hedge, but I mean it not in a bad way. It's just a way to protect them against any changes that happen in medicine.
Frank Brody graduated last spring, and now he's working at a safety net hospital in Los Angeles. When he noticed that some people in the urgent care clinic had to wait hours just to get a 10-minute consult, he suggested a new way to do things.
So kind of thinking about supply chain management and stuff like that, ways to think I learned in Wharton, we have started trying to triage those patients really quickly to the front.
Brody is also using his degrees as a physician entrepreneur. The 32-year-old launched two startup companies while he was still a graduate student at Wharton. He says he'll always practice medicine and see patients, but Brody's already working on his next business project. This time, it's a medical device that could be used by eye doctors.
We don't even have a sexy name yet. So right now, I'm collaborating with the folks at Caltech, as well as some clinicians up at UCSF, to see how we can design some studies to test it and show that it's safe and efficacious.
For now, he has no expectations that he'll get rich from his business endeavors. And actually, Brody says it's his workaday doctor salary that gives him financial stability to be an entrepreneur.
So hopefully I can pull it off. Hopefully I can have that kind of hybrid life where I get to stay both as a clinician and also in this business world. So we'll see.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. Only about 50% of people with depression respond to antidepressant medications. Researchers are trying to improve those odds by better understanding the mechanisms that cause this illness. At the University of Pennsylvania, scientists are now investigating a link between inflammation and depression. And joining us now is Yvette Chalene. She heads the Center for Neuromodulation in Depression and Stress at Penn. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm really delighted to be here.
What's your take on the potential connection between inflammation and depression?
So that's something that we've started to study. We're actually doing a study examining that because there's good evidence that people with depression have more inflammation, both in their peripheral blood and in their brain. And there are excellent animal models where we can actually look inside the brain to see how that happens. People who have depression have a much higher level of something called interleukin or IL-6. And this factor, this cytokine, is associated with decreases in cognitive performance and increase in the risk for depression. So in animal models, you can have just the tiniest amount. And when you expose the animal to that chronically, they get depressed. With humans, if you induce this artificially with interferon, which is a treatment for cancer, then about a quarter of the people who've never had depression before get depressed. So those are some of the ways in which we know that there's really inflammation involved in depression.
What is IL-6?
IL-6 is a cytokine. So it's something that is produced naturally in the body to fight off infection. But if you have too much of it, I mean, what we're seeing is that then it can produce depression. So it's also something that, I mean, another reason that we're really interested in inflammation is because we've noticed that people with late life depression have harder to treat depression. And as you age, you start to produce more of these cytokines. So it was called by somebody, I forget who, the gerontologist's cytokine, IL-6, because as we age, we get more. And things that can produce it are things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity. These are all things that are associated with inflammation. So it's kind of like you get a double whammy. You've got aging and you've got depression. So you've got late life depression. And so the likelihood is that you may have a treatable inflammation that we could treat along with depression and get you a better treatment response.
So a normal amount of IL-6 is a good thing.
Yes.
But when the levels go up, that's when it starts to cause problems.
Exactly. Because what it actually does is it degrades serotonin, which is one of the neurotransmitters involved in depression. Too much cytokines, it produces a degradation of serotonin.
So what can treatment providers do to reduce the amount of IL-6?
Well, first of all, I think there's a couple steps before we get there. So we nor anybody else has actually shown a causal link between inflammation and depression. There have been these anecdotal findings, but our study, when we finish it, will be the first to actually measure cytokines in the spinal fluid, in, you know, that bathes the brain, to see what the levels are. And then we'll see if the people who get well are the people who have lower levels, and the people who have a more difficult time getting a treatment response are the people who have higher levels. So that's the first step. We're actually going to add a second step where we add in an anti-inflammatory agent with the antidepressant. So people will first get treated with an antidepressant, and we'll see if that lowers the amount of inflammation they have and lowers their depression. Then in the second step, we'll add in an anti-inflammatory agent and see if that gives them an improved treatment response.
And it also seems to be another step into the direction of integrating mental and physical health. It just seems the more we learn, the less that distinction makes sense.
Right, right. Well, I think, I certainly hope that dualism is dead and that we see ourselves as having one holistic body, brain, and the rest of it.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I really appreciate your having me here.
Yvette Chalene heads the Center for Neuromodulation in Depression and Stress at the University of Pennsylvania. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. A couple of my colleagues have been a little sick lately. It's that time of year when the weather is changing, the pollen is out, everybody is sneezing and sniffling. So we started talking about the foods we crave when we're sick and whether there's any science behind these cravings. Carolyn Beeler is one of the people in the newsroom with the spring sniffles, so we asked her to find out.
I started off my investigation by asking people what their moms gave them when they were sick as kids, and I came up with three super scientific categories of sick food. The first, things that are soothing on your throat, from soft-boiled eggs.
It made me feel better.
Do you know why?
I don't know. Gooiness, I guess.
To fish food ice cream, to, more predictably, tea.
It doesn't matter what happened. It would be like, did you drink any tea yet? I just twisted my ankle. But did you drink tea? Okay, I'll drink it.
I ran these remedies by nutritionist Rebecca Katz, who's written a cookbook for cancer patients undergoing treatment. She gave a thumbs up to the hard-boiled eggs and a thumbs down to ice cream. Dairy adds to the phlegm that's already overloading your system when you have a cold. And tea? Katz says yes.
Hydration, hydration, hydration. I can't say it enough.
Cold liquids take more energy for your body to heat up, but sipping hot ones can help loosen nasal mucus.
Which is really why you want hot liquids when you're sick.
Back out on the street, the second sick food category I found, I'll call it bland. Emma Wingrove describes it perfectly.
Crackers and ginger ale.
And why do you think that that's what you eat when you're sick?
Because that's what I crave.
It's sort of neutral on your tummy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it make you feel better?
Sometimes.
Katz's verdict?
We kind of think that this person is sick, so I have to feed them really bland sick food. But actually, it's more the opposite.
Unless you're suffering from digestive issues, flavor is your friend when you're sick, Katz says. Nutrient-dense ingredients that boost immune function also tend to be really flavorful.
When you're really trying to feed the body to heal, that's when you want to go with things like thyme and mint and honey and garlic and ginger and coconut milk.
The third category of sick food I found was...
I crave chicken noodle soup. Clear broth, a little bit of chicken. It's just like mom used to make, you know what I mean?
This is not just a Western tradition. There's an entire sniffling universe worth of chicken soups and their relatives out there. Homemade chicken soup by a mom from Barbados.
Plenty of vegetables, plenty of fresh vegetables in it. and she made it with peppers.
A chicken and rice porridge in Indonesia.
Bubur, in Indonesian, like bubur ayam, in a local language.
A veggie-rich Syrian soup.
I tried to make the most of the lentils and the spinach with kale, the green things, which is more healthier.
And an extra spicy chicken curry from India.
If I really have like in coal, so she makes some curries with like in more pepper in it, so I can get rid of the coal soon.
There is some research on the healing properties of this ubiquitous dish. A tiny study found chicken broth was a bit better than plain hot water at clearing nasal mucus. And the most cited evidence, a 2000 study from the University of Nebraska, where Dr. Stephen Renard tested matzo ball soup to see if it inhibited the movement of the most common type of white blood cell, called neutrophils. Here he is talking in an old press video.
What we showed was that grandma's chicken soup had some very modest but clearly measurable ability to reduce the ability of those cells to move.
These cells, neutrophils, fight infection, but in the process they also cause muscle aches and congestion. Slowing down their deployment allows them to work enough to fight your virus, but not enough to overdo it and cause you more misery than necessary. That's what the chicken soup did in blood samples and could do in people.
If it resulted in fewer cells, for example, in your throat when you got a virus, you could speculate that that could lead to less symptoms.
Renard couldn't identify which ingredient was at work here, but he says it may be a combination of the chicken and vegetables together. None of this research is conclusive, and it doesn't address why chicken soup is better than any other kind.
I think, really, it's about having a warm, soothing broth.
Rebecca Katz again.
Whether it's a nutrient-dense vegetable stock or chicken soup. I think there's a lot of wisdom in craving warm liquids.
Chicken soup combines the mucus-clearing properties of hot liquids with the nutrients of vegetables and spices, and adds soothing memories of a hot bowl being served to you out of love many colds ago. By the way, Dad, you were the chicken soup master in our house. If you're listening, I think you're allowed to send liquids in the mail. Just saying. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Chicken noodle soup, chicken noodle soup, chicken noodle soup with a soda on the side.
Yeah.
Chicken noodle soup,
yeah.
Chicken noodle soup,
yeah.
Chicken noodle soup,
yeah.
With a soda on the side.
And now I'm really hungry and I want chicken soup. But we're going to stay here for a moment. Coming up on The Pulse, we get into some serious pro wrestling.
I'm coming for you! All I'm hearing is how you're the new number one around here. Well, let me ask you one question, Tim. How can some guy looking like a punk be number one?
But that screaming wrestler is not at all scary compared to what was really coming for Tim Donst. Up next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on transforming cutting-edge science into meaningful medicines. On Twitter at AstraZenecaUS or on Facebook at AstraZenecaUS Community Connections.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Imagine you have one all-consuming passion in life, the thing you can't live without, and suddenly an illness threatens to take this very thing away from you. In our series Patient Files, your stories of illness, coping, and healing, we hear from Michael Hopes of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He's 27 years old, he's a pro wrestler, and in the wrestling world, he is known as Tim Donst.
Yeah! Tim Donst!
Dark, moody, definitely not a dude you'd want to invite over for a pizza party or anything else like that.
As Tim Donst, Michael Hopes wears a leather jacket. His hair is messy. He describes his look as unkempt. Hopes has had a successful career so far. He's held several pro wrestling titles, but right now his future is uncertain. I caught up with him 3 days before he was having a very serious surgery, but all he wanted to talk about was wrestling.
When I was 16 years old, I began training. I was in high school. I was collegiately wrestling. I also did a little bit of theater. So to me, it was kind of like the perfect mesh between both those worlds.
Well, he lettered in wrestling at high school. He went to college on a wrestling scholarship.
Lots of times hitting the canvas, bouncing off the ropes. If you don't hit them exactly right, the steel cables completely rip up your back. Lots of push-ups, too many squats. Lots of running around.
Right, Donce does have a little bit of a size advantage, a little bit of a power advantage. But as
I've had my fair share number of concussions, unfortunately, as well as some other nagging injuries here and there. It's kind of one of those things where you always hurt, so you kind of just get used to it. Every weekend, we're fighting for another paycheck. We have to go through injuries. I've missed so many funerals, weddings, party invitations, just because I want to do what I want to do, and that's professional wrestle. I love the improv aspect of it. I love traveling the world. I love meeting different people. I love the idea that you can tell a story with just two different individuals, and you can convey that story. I've wrestled in Japan where we couldn't speak to each other, obviously, because of the communication barrier. And the fact we were able to have a good match really says a lot.
I've wrestled in like 56 states. I even went to Japan. I got this hat. You never did that. Go to Japan or get a Japanese hat.
Recently, I was unfortunately diagnosed with a tumor inside my kidney. I had stabbing back pains all along my right side that completely knocked me off my feet. I couldn't move, and I was rushed to the ER, where it took them a long time because of my age to figure out exactly what it was, unfortunately. So it was first told to me I'd never wrestle again, which completely broke my heart, and now I'm trying to contradict that, hopefully. I'll be getting my kidney removed. That's when they're going to see exactly how far the cancer has spread. The idea as of now is hopefully it's contained to the kidney.
And I'll tell you what, Donce might just be out. Donce got knocked clean over the guardrail.
Well, they tell me I'm going to be in the hospital for about 5 days. My pain tolerance is pretty darn good, so I'm going to try to cut that down to 2. They tell me I'm going to need 6 weeks of recovery. I'm going to try to cut that down to 4. I also don't plan on having a patty cake match back. I want the kind of a hardcore match. I think that'd be fun. Push myself all the way. No? You're shaking your head no. That's a bad idea. I'm sure my mom and everyone else would agree with you. I'm not willing to not live my life without any risks, because that wouldn't be much living at all.
You want to kill me? Kill me, Ken! I'll kill you! I'll kill you!
Come out!
It was never in my mind a life or death thing, even when they told me they weren't sure how serious it was. The only thing I could focus on, whether it be an escapism or not, was the fact I would never be in the ring again, because I love it so much. And I spent so much time thinking about wrestling and moves and promos, that when that aspect of my life was taken away, it was almost like my mind couldn't comprehend, because I had to fill those voids with other things. It scares me that I don't have a backup plan, but I don't think you can be really successful at anything unless you completely devote your entire life to it. And I've chosen to do that in this perhaps one of the weirdest respected sports in the world.
Since I talked to Michael Hopes, a.k.a. Tim Donst, he had his kidney removed, and doctors say the tumor was confined to the organ, so no further treatment is needed at this time. He hopes to return to the ring within a few weeks and do one of his signature moves, the Donstitution. And what we're listening to here is his fight song, Heartjacker by Recluse. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott from the wrestling ring back into the halls of academia. When we discuss the impact of obesity, we're usually talking about health issues like diabetes or heart disease, or we're talking about the medical costs associated with obesity. But a Wharton researcher examines how obesity changes people's careers and impacts their chances for advancing in their jobs. Maurice Schweitzer joins us now to talk about his work. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What happens to people's careers when they are overweight or obese? What have you found?
That's a great question. What we found in our research is that obese people are discriminated against. They're perceived to be less competent than their non-obese counterparts. And we found that that's true even when we control for their actual performance. we find this actual form of discrimination, obese people are judged to be less competent.
So what does that translate to?
Well, it means that when you're selected for a promotion, when you get credit for a group project, obese people are less likely to get the credit that they deserve. They're expected to perform at a lower level than they actually are capable of performing at.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it comes from we perceive obese people to have violated this norm of self-control. We perceive obesity to be a choice. We justify, we think it's okay to discriminate against people for obesity in a way that's not accepted for other physical features. So to characterize somebody about their race, their ethnicity, other physical features would be taboo, but somehow it's acceptable to discriminate against somebody for their weight. We feel as if they chose it, and because they chose it, the gloves come off when it comes to discrimination.
How did you go about doing this research?
So in this research, we looked at this question in a number of different ways. In one study, we actually took photos from Jeopardy contestants, three contestants who had actually competed together, and we asked people to judge, who do you think won this contest? When we actually look at who won the contest, the weight of the contestants doesn't matter at all. But when you ask people to make their judgments, who do you think won, they're far more likely to think that the thin person or the normal weight person won the contest. We then looked at resume. We did a resume study. We did resume studies with photos, without photos. We did without photos condition, we just had numbers. So we used the average weight male, average weight female with the average height. And then we had another condition where we had people who were obese. So with just numbers, just text alone, we find overt discrimination. What's interesting about that study is it suggests that our reaction to obesity is not just a visceral reaction. That is, it's not just seeing somebody that triggers this effect. Seeing numbers, text alone, will do it, suggesting that there's a cognitive component to how we're discriminating against other people.
How should managers think about this issue in the workplace?
Yeah, interesting. I think managers need to be aware of the potential for bias. And just as we've worked really hard to try to select and promote people irrespective of their gender, irrespective of their race, ethnicity, we need to also think about ways to select and promote people based upon weight. What we think about is blind screening processes, thinking about making more objective decisions based upon criteria we decide ahead of time. So we decide, hey, I'm going to look at these performance metrics. Maybe it's sales. Maybe it's some other productivity measure. That's what's going to determine who gets the raise, who gets the promotion, and stick to those criteria. When we make subjective judgments, that's where our biases are most likely to get expressed.
How receptive are CEOs to talking about this? If I think about, you know, Wharton MBA students, I think of a bunch of trim, fit people in well-tailored suits. So how open are people to talking about this topic?
I know from some of the feedback I've received that there are some people out there who don't perceive this to be a bias, who perceive this to be a justified informative factor, and for whom my research won't be very compelling. But if I were to tell you today, 68% of Americans are overweight. If you're the CEO of a mid-sized or large organization, there is no way that you can staff your organization without some of these people. You will have people that are overweight. That's the makeup of the American demographic. We need to figure out a way to make sure that we're not discriminating against people who are performing well.
Maurice, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Maurice Schweitzer is a professor at the Wharton School, and he talked about obesity being viewed as a choice or not. What's your take on that? Send us an email at thepulse@whyy.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now we're going to hear a story about a sound that many people find really, really aggravating and kind of disgusting.
It's a habit, a bad habit.
I cringe when you hear your knuckles crack. The sound of your daughter's fingers or her knuckles cracking is almost like grating on a board. It's of that order of disturbance.
I just can't stop.
And what causes that crack has been a mystery until now. Alana Gordon reports that a few curious researchers have a new discovery on this issue, and their work was just published in the Journal of Public Science.
Greg Kochuk is all about knuckle cracking these days.
Try it. Come on.
I'm not so good at this, so I asked some colleagues to help me out.
That's all I got. Sorry.
Can you crack your knuckles?
I'm going to try. Ready?
Oh, yeah. That was good. Clench those fists, stretch those hands, and...
You might hear bang. This pop that happens.
Kochuk teaches rehabilitative medicine at the University of Alberta in Canada. And he says the cause of that crack in that metacarpal phalangeal joint is a bit of a mystery.
It's not terribly clear in the literature what actually happens.
In the late 40s, scientists theorized that when the bones suddenly pulled apart, that crack came from a gas bubble that would form in the fluid in between those joint surfaces.
In the same way that you might have a gas bubble created when you open up a can of pop or soda.
But by the 70s, researchers were headed in the exact opposite direction on this. They thought that a gas bubble was already there, and when the bones quickly pulled apart, the bubble would collapse and... So which was it? Or was it something totally different? Scientists were limited in what they could actually observe because of the available imaging technology at the time.
So it's been a real mess. No one's really come to any conclusion about what it is that causes this sound.
The mystery of this crack does not appear to be keeping doctors or chiropractors up at night. But Kochuk and his colleagues wanted to know. Then they realized that no one had yet used modern technology that would enable them to actually view this phenomenon and put this debate to rest.
Once we figured out, that no one had done this yet, no one had taken a motion MRI or movie of what was happening in the joint, we basically ran into the MRI.
Okay, it wasn't that straightforward. First, they needed the right test subject.
Someone who can perform at showtime, right?
And crack on demand. They were in luck. Kochuk's colleague who had the idea for this whole thing in the first place, he had real talent.
He turned out, we're calling him the Wayne Gretzky of knuckle cracking.
Gretzky! He did it!
This guy can do it in all 10 fingers. And if you wait 15 minutes and things equilibrate again, he can do it again. And that was pretty important because it takes a while to get someone set up.
About that setup, what they did was tie a rope to their colleague's finger, who was all hooked up to the motion MRI. Then they gently pull on that rope to make the knuckle crack.
You could feel it happening through the rope.
Then they'd run around to the control desk and look at the screen to see what had happened.
Our jaws were on the floor. It was like, wow, we can't believe what we're seeing.
What they first saw was a white flash. Kochuk thinks that's the liquid, the synovial fluid that lubricates the joints. But as the bones pulled apart from that finger tug...
And then magically we saw this black cavity form at the same time that the sound was produced.
It was a gas bubble, and it stayed there after the crack. To Kochuk, this was evidence supporting that original theory that the creation... not the collapse of a gas bubble, caused the crack. Kochuk says the real mystery now is why knuckle cracking does not seem to cause major joint problems or arthritis, as people had once thought.
To us, it's a nice, curious study. It's a lot of fun to do a study called the Pull My Finger Study. But in the end, we're really hoping that it helps us understand why some joints remain healthy over time and others may not.
That, he says, may require a lot more finger pulling. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And we have a video of that knuckle-cracking MRI in slow motion on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And if that's not enough Pulse for you, we also have a newsletter. Why would you want that? Because you can find out, just as one example, why doctors wear bow ties. Is it fashion statement? Is it germ busting? Subscribe to the newsletter at whyy.org/pulse newsletter. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.